Brian, we haven't moved out of Hebrews chapter 7 since you left. We're getting closer. We're in the last paragraph.
You're dealing with numbers. Take this weight stuff.
We're in the last two paragraphs of Hebrews 7. Only gone 2 months, but that's okay. No, it wasn't really 2 months. So. We got through three verses in that 2 months. That's congratulations. No, we're Hebrews 7. We are in this 23 and following statement, and there are four things that we're focusing on. Four things that as he summarizes the whole statement, his whole argument of why Jesus is superior to the priesthood, why Jesus is superior to the Aaronic priesthood. He's now in this process. He's summarizing his argument, and he gives four proofs or four statements that demonstrate his preeminence, if you will. And the first is his permanence. He's a permanent priest. He lives forever, so he's able to always make intercession for those who draw near to God. So he's a permanent priest. Remember, there were many others. The other priests were many in number because they died and had to be replaced. Jesus never dies. He never has to be replaced. He's always in that position. He's permanently in that position. So that was the first thing we looked at. Then we looked at his purity, which is in verses 26, for indeed fitting that we should have such a high priest who is holy, innocent, unstained, separated from sinners. That's the purity. We talked about that as it really sets him apart, purity before God and purity as he represents man. And so sets in a position that no other high priest had. No other priest in and of himself was pure. He always had to make sacrifice for himself first and then offer sacrifice for the people. Jesus, because of his perfection, because of his sinlessness, his innocence, his blamelessness, is pure and therefore never had to make that offer for himself. So he doesn't have the same that against him. So that sets him above the Aaronic priests. Now we're ready to move on to the next two. Those are the next two. So we're actually going to start kind of at the end of that statement where he's listed five things. He listed holy, innocent, unstained, separated from sinners, and exalted above the heavens. And exalted above the heavens. That's his place. His place is a place that no other high priest is. We're in verse 26. 26. Exalted above the heavens. His place is in a place where no other priest ever would be. No other priest was exalted above the heavens. In fact, the priests, like the Aaronic priests, were just Levites who had been chosen by God to do this purpose, but they were not in and of themselves exalted in any way. They were not placed in any special position or exalted above the heavens. Remember, this came as a result of the work Jesus did on the earth. Philippians chapter 2 walks through Jesus, willing emptying of himself to come to earth, to give himself for us, to take the form of a servant and to die on a cross. And because of that, what has happened to Jesus? Because of that, God has highly exalted him and given him a name that's above every name. That the name of Jesus, every knee should bow and every tongue confess that Jesus is Lord to the glory of God the Father. He is in a highly exalted position. He's in a highly exalted place. Hebrews chapter 1, 1 through 3. After making purification for sins, what happened? He sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high. Because of his work on earth, because of his perfect work on earth, because of his complete work on earth, because he made purification for sins, he did all of that. Now he has been placed in this highly exalted position, and he is exalted above the heavens. There's not you can't say that of any priest. You can't say that about any one of the other priests. Aaron was not exalted above the heavens. Aaron died. Every other priest, every other high priest died. There's no high priest that is in that position. And the reason is no other high priest did what Jesus did. No other high priest actually made purification for sins. Every other priest only made atonement for sin. And that atonement had to be done over and over and over again, because it was simply a covering. It wasn't a purifying of. And so there's, because of what he did, he is now in this place that is above every other place. He's in a position that sets him above every, so his place is exalted above the heavens. And it's important to recognize what he's doing as he's exalted above the heavens, where he is at the right hand of the Majesty on High. What is his function there? Well, we know he's ruling. He's definitely ruling as the ruler, the sustainer, the upholder of all things. But more specifically, in context of the priesthood, what he's doing is he's making intercession for us. He goes on to that next. He says there he has no need to offer sacrifice daily for his own sins and for those people. He does once for all when he offered up himself. So he is there, and he is in the process, I think, of executing his office, executing the job of high priest, making intercession for us. That's encouraging. That should be encouraging for us, because as the high priest making intercession for us, he is sitting, he is right there next at the right hand of God making intercession for us. It's not like he has to go through this series of steps or veils or anything to get to the presence of God. He is right there in the presence of God because he is God. And so there's no distance. So when he stands as our intercessor, he stands immediately before God interceding for us at his very right hand. So that's encouraging, because there's no distance between the two, between the judge, because he actually is the same guy. But so there's encouragement there, that because of his position, because of where he's making intercession for us, and he's doing it immediately without distance. There's no separation. There's no wall. There's no hindrance to his intercessory work for us on our behalf. And that's we should find that as encouraging. That is not the case for any other priest. Not the case for any other priest. Every other priest, every other high priest could not just any day he wanted to go, walk into the Holy of Holies and make intercession for the people. Couldn't happen. In fact, the high priest could only do it one day a year, and only after a series of purifications, of cleansings, of washings for himself, and then only after the bull had been killed, and only after all that had happened, then he could take the blood, and then he would zigzag through the veil back into the Holy of Holies, and there he would offer first for his own sin, and then he would offer for the sins of the people. There was a distance, there was separation, it wasn't just always 24/7, 365, eternal access to God on the part of the high priest. On the part of Jesus, there is that. He's right there making himself. So that his permanence, his purity, and his place are three indications of his superiority to the other priests, any other high priest. So those are three. The last one is because his position, starting in verse 28. For the law appoints men in their weakness as high priests, but the word of the oath, which came later than the law, appoints a son who's been made perfect forever. So the law appoints men in their weakness as high priests. The high priests were in effect servants of God. They were appointed to be servants of God in their weakness. But that's not Jesus. Jesus wasn't appointed because he was a servant in the tribe of Levi. He was appointed by an oath. We looked at the oath a few weeks ago, how I've sworn. That's Psalm 110 again. You're a priest forever after the Melchizedek. I've sworn that to you. Let's go back to verse 21. The Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever. And the rest of that statement is after the order of Melchizedek. So there is an oath that God swore to the Son that he would be a priest forever. And this is significant because it's only sworn to a son. It's not sworn to those servants. So his position is the position of a son, not the position of a servant. And so when I, you know, it, if you send, if you're treating a servant, you might really like a servant, but I think there's a different relationship between father and son than master to servant. I think there's clearly a different relationship. Who can pull the heartstrings of a father more, a servant of that father or the son of that father? I think clearly daughter. The son of the father, a daughter, absolutely. I've got girls, so I understand that. They can pull those little heartstrings really good. But in case of what we're talking about here, I think even the fact that he is a son, not a servant, indicates the relationship that he has with the Father. And as he then intercedes for us on our behalf, he's interceding before the Father as a son. And that puts in a position, that puts him in a position that no other priest can claim. No other high priest can claim sonship. They can claim servanthood, but they cannot claim sonship. They can't claim we are the very Son of God. They can't do that. Only one person has God ever sworn that oath to, and that one person is Jesus. No other. It's interesting. He doesn't even swear that oath to Melchizedek. The oath is sworn to the Son that he's a priest after the order of Melchizedek, but not to Melchizedek. Why? Because Melchizedek was a man who would pass away, who would die, and who would not continue in his priesthood. Jesus, however, is a man who is permanent and pure and in the right place now, and his position is that of a son who will never pass away. And because of that, there's been an oath sworn to him. So not only is his priesthood secure and based on his work on the earth, but it's also based in the word of God to his son, placing him in that position. And so that really then solidifies his place as the high priest. And again, to summarize all of it, he's not the high priest just for Israel. He's the high priest for everyone. And he is the one who then, because of his perfect, because of his position as son, because of his perfect life on the earth, because of his substitutionary death on a cross, because of his powerful resurrection from the grave, and because of his exalted position in heaven, he is the one, and he is the only one who serves to offer intercession and make intercession for us who believe. That is significant. You going to say something, Jason? There will always be I'll go all the way to eternal state. Okay, I'll go all the way to there. But all through the millennial kingdom, there will be a priesthood. There will be the priest, Jesus, the high priest, who acts as that high priest for all mankind. Absolutely, there will be. I get there because of Ezekiel. Ezekiel 44 through 46 talks about this millennial temple that Ezekiel sees. Ezekiel sees a temple that's built he gives the dimensions of that temple. It's clear reading Ezekiel, at least it's clear to me, and we're not going to go there today. We'll do Ezekiel maybe in the next century. We'll get to Ezekiel. But it seems clear to me after reading Ezekiel 44 and following that temple is the temple in the millennial kingdom, that the temple that's established. And so now we got to walk through upcoming history and temples. We got to walk through upcoming temples. When this is written, when the New Testament is written, there is a temple in place, Herod's temple, right? Herod's temple, which is a refurbishing or a renovation of Zerubbabel's temple that was built back in 536 to 516 BC. That's when that temple was built. The first temple, Solomon's temple, was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar. And then Cyrus issued a decree in 536 BC, saying that the Jews can go back to their land and rebuild their temple. That's the decree he issues. They start that in 536 BC, and because because of certain events, it takes them 20 years to get it done. And they finish the temple, and that's called Zerubbabel's temple. In about 34 BC, Herod the Great, who is an Edomite, an Edomian, wants to gain favor with the Israelites, wants to gain favor with the Jews because he recognizes, I'm a descendant of Esau. There's no way the Jews will like me. And the Jews hate him. The Jews absolutely hate him. So to gain favor with them, he reestablishes or rebuilds or refurbishes that temple. That's when the Temple Mount that we see today, that's when that Temple Mount is constructed. He builds those retaining walls. The walls that we see are retaining walls that were retaining walls not for the temple itself, retaining walls just for the base. I'm going to get this wrong, and Ron, correct me if I'm wrong. It's like 40 acres. He makes a 40-acre square or rectangle up there, and he takes and builds the mountain up, so it's a flat-topped, 40-acre flat top up there. And then on top of that, he then builds his temple, which is, it's a refurbishing of it's the same Holy of Holies, the same holy place. That's all the same. It's just regilded with all this gold and made to look just amazingly beautiful. It's like a wonder of the ancient world, Herod's temple. It's a big, big deal. That temple never gets completed and is destroyed in 70 AD by the Romans as they come and they destroy Israel. There's not been a temple in that place since. There's not been a temple there. It's not there. There will be a temple. I think Revelation makes it pretty clear. There will be a temple during the tribulation time. I actually think that's one of the ways. I think it follows with what Herod did to ingratiate himself to the Jews. I think it's what the Antichrist is going to do to ingratiate himself to the Jews. He's going to build them a temple. He's going to be the ruler of all the earth. He's not going to care what the Muslims think about the Dome of the Rock getting torn down. He could care less about that. He's going to do what he can to ingratiate himself to even the Jews, because I think they're going to gain. I think because of what I believe the Bible teaches, they're going to gain some prominence again. As the tribulation's going, they're going to gain prominence with a peace treaty that's signed with this guy. And I think he's going to build them a temple. So there will be a temple in the tribulation time. There will be a temple. Maybe that happens before the tribulation starts. I have a hard time with that, just because that would cause World War 75. It would cause it. It would be bad. If the Jews were to seize that Temple Mount and destroy the Dome of the Rock, it'd be over. Iran would go after them with nukes. Russia would back them up. We would, of course, have to. It'd be just a crazy, crazy deal. Could it happen? Yes, but that temple wouldn't last long because it would be destroyed. But there will be a temple in the tribulation. Revelation makes it clear there's a temple. In fact, it's so clear there's a temple that halfway through, the Antichrist then sets himself up as God by going into the Holy of Holies and offering himself there as God, making it, I am God. That's what he's going to do 3.5 years in. And then that's going to be great tribulation. That temple and the city of Jerusalem is destroyed by an earthquake. In the book of Revelation, it talks about an earthquake that's going to destroy the city of Jerusalem. I believe destroy that temple. So that's the third temple. And then there's the fourth temple. The fourth temple is a temple that's going to be rebuilt. And it's going to be in Jerusalem, and that's the millennial temple. That's the one that's going to be there for the 1,000-year reign of Jesus. There will be a fourth temple there.
Ezekiel's?
That's Ezekiel's temple. I believe that is the temple that Ezekiel is talking about. And if you follow that with Ezekiel, there is a priesthood in place offering sacrifice, doing that throughout the millennial kingdom. Happens. Why? I think it's more of a as and if Ron disagrees with me, he can say he disagrees, and that's all he can say. Because we're not going there today. Again, this isn't an Ezekiel study. This is a different study. And I'm the teacher. He's not. So I get that. So I believe what's going to happen, it's not going to be so that sin can be covered. It's going to be because sin has been covered as a memorial to, as a remembrance of the sacrifice Jesus made. There's going to be that continual sacrifice going on. And again, it's not going to be because Jesus has to go in and offer sin for himself. Although there is discussion in Ezekiel about this prince or this leader. Leader or the prince clearly is not Jesus, because the prince or leader in Ezekiel has to first offer sacrifice for his own sin before he offers it for the people. So how in the world is there sin in the millennial kingdom? How does that fit? Well, I thought that in the eternal state that we are like angels and we don't marry, aren't given in marriage, and so there we won't have children. Where do the kids come from? Where does sin come from? Well, I think sin comes from at the end of the tribulation, there's this judgment called the sheep-goat judgment, Matthew 24, 25, 26. There's a sheep-goat judgment. And that sheep goat judgment is a judgment of nations based on how a nation treated Israel. And I believe I can make the case, I'm not going to do this morning, I can make the case, it's a judgment of nations based on how that nation treated Israel during the tribulation time. and because of the question that's asked or the judgment that's made is, when I was hungry, you fed me. When I was naked, you gave me clothes. Thirsty, you gave me something to drink. And he goes through that, and they say, hey, wait, when did we do that? And Jesus says, as much as you did it to one of the least of these, my brothers, you did it to me. Who in that context, who are the brothers of Jesus? They're the Jewish people. And so it's based on that. And so you're going to have, and I believe those people don't enter the millennial kingdom in an eternal state. They go just like they are. And they're the ones that are having kids. They're the ones that are there's still sin in the millennial kingdom. Satan's bound, but the flesh isn't abolished yet. It's still there. It's still going on. And based on that, then there will be some sacrifice still going on. But again, the sacrifice that takes sin away has already been done. But there'll be a memorial of that going on. So that's through the millennial kingdom. And then at the end of the millennial kingdom, we know Satan is loosed for a little season, and he goes, and there are so many people who still have the capacity for sin that he gathers with him a great army to come against Jesus at the end of the millennial kingdom. At the end of 1,000 years of Jesus' rulership on the earth, at the end of that 1,000 years, there's still enough unsaved or unregenerate people on the earth that there can be a great army raised by Satan to come against him. Got to be real clear, that is not the Battle of Armageddon. That is a separate battle that comes at the end of the millennial kingdom. Battle of Armageddon comes at the end of the tribulation. So it's 1,000 years. Battle of Armageddon is 1,000 years before this last battle that takes place.
It's also not the Gog and Magog.
It's also not Gog and Magog. Gog and Magog happens before the Battle of Armageddon, I believe. Before the tribulation, I think too. And I'm agreeing with him a lot. That's really scary at this point. But so then there's the eternal state. In the New Jerusalem, there's a tree of life. There's a throne of God. I don't know that there'll be a temple in the New Jerusalem. So that's why I can say, through the millennial kingdom, I can say that, but I don't know past that at this point. And I think that as he talks about the eternal priest, as he talks about that, it may be that he always will still function in that role eternally, because he never dies, and that function, that part of him as the one who offered himself for all, never goes away. reason that we can be acceptable to God is because of that eternal sacrifice that he offered. That might be what talks about the eternal. But I'm confident that throughout the Millennial Kingdom there will be a temple in place. And there will be a priesthood offering sacrifice. So that was a really long answer to a really short question. No, I hope it helped. As I guess I'm saying I hope it helped. It didn't just take us on a path that made no sense. We're speeding up to stop right now. Go ahead. For he has no need to, like those high priests, to offer sacrifices daily, first for his own sins and then for those of the people. Since this is once for all when he offered up himself. Since he has no need, like those high priests, to offer up sacrifices daily, first for his own sins and then for those of the people, since he did this once for all when he offered up himself.
It's just describing first for his own sins.
Yeah. So.
Okay. So is that saying that the sins that did he actually have sin at that point?
No.
Our sin was imputed to him.
I don't believe that's what it's saying. I've heard that argument. I don't believe that's what it's saying at all. I think he's taking what the high priest had to do and contrasting that with what Jesus did. And I think here's the deal. And the key is the once for all. The key is the once for all statement. Remember the high priest, when he's doing the Day of Atonement, when he is offering the Day of Atonement sacrifice, he has to go in first for himself, come back out, and then go back in for the people. Ron would say four times. I'm good with that. I'm good with four times. As you walk through the process and the understanding of but one of the times he went in was for himself. The next time he went in was for the people. Okay? So that's a contrast of the two times, himself and people, with the one time. That's the contrast there. The contrast is Jesus didn't have to go in twice. He didn't have to go in twice. That's the significance. He went in once. He went in once and offered his own blood for all. The inference there is, he went in once because he didn't have to offer sacrifice for himself. He didn't have to sprinkle blood for himself because his blood was pure, his blood was perfect, and there was no sin in him. There was no sin in him.
Am I wrong then that our sin was imputed to him?
No, our sin was absolutely imputed to him. And our sin was judged on the cross. And the payment was made on the cross. That's where the payment was made. So I guess it goes to this. Yes, that's when the purification is complete. I guess I'll say it that way. I'm trying to make sure that I say this right. The penalty was paid. What is the just payment, the just penalty for sin? It is death. It's not blood sprinkled. The just payment for sin, the penalty for sin is death. So when was that penalty paid? When the price was paid at the cross when Jesus died. That's when the price was paid. The purification was complete when Jesus sprinkled his blood on the mercy seat in heaven. That's when the price had been paid. Okay, this is the best analogy I can give you. It will fall apart. Analogy busters, you got it. I get it. It'll fall apart. All right? I can pay off my car, right? Well, I can't pay off my car because I don't know anything on it. But if I was to pay off my house, let's say that I pay off my house, the day I make the final payment, is that paid in full? Absolutely is. Is the lien released at that very day? No. There's a legal transaction that has to take place after the payment is paid to make it effective, right? So at death, Jesus' death on the cross, the payment was made in full for sin. But there had to be a legal transaction take place that appropriated that payment for all who believe. And that's the blood sprinkling on the mercy seat in heaven. Was my sin imputed to Jesus? Absolutely it was. That's why Jesus cried out, my God, why have you forsaken me? There'd be no other reason for the Father to forsake the Son. None whatsoever. It's only because, and I believe that's at that moment, that is when my sin was imputed to him, was when he cried out, my God, why have you forsaken me? Because that's when it happened. That's when it happened. And then he died. It is finished, and he died. He gave up the ghost, proven to be dead because they ran the spear up him, and water, blood, and plasma came out. His blood had separated, proving he was dead. And his death paid that. He was, and I think Paul talks about it in Romans, that he was delivered for our offenses and raised for our justification. So the payment is made at death on the cross, but justification happens through resurrection, and I think is appropriated through the sprinkling of blood on the mercy seat. But he didn't sprinkle tainted blood on the mercy seat. He didn't. He sprinkled his own pure blood on that mercy seat. So there was no sin. There was no, I don't know of anyone who holds the position that he offered that his sacrifice, the blood sprinkled, was for his own sin too. I don't know if anyone holds that position. I definitely don't hold that position, because he offered his pure blood on that mercy seat as the only satisfying sacrifice. Only satisfying sacrifice.
I'm not trying to engage in foolish speculation by saying this at all, but when you look at these things, you try to look at these things sequentially. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if it could have been simultaneous. In other words, is it possible that Christ, I mean, he was God, mm-hmm. is it possible that he was operating?
Yeah, I don't think so. And I think Scripture gives us a clue that that's not the case. And the clue that Scripture gives us is when Mary in the garden sees Jesus, and she's wondering where he is, and she's crying, and he reveals himself to her, and she goes, and she's grabbing onto him. And he says to her, King James, don't touch me, but the real better translation is, don't hold on to me. Don't hold on me, because, what's the reason? Because I haven't yet been to my Father, which gives us a sequence. It gives us sequential. It's interesting. The next time he sees Mary, she grabs onto him, and he doesn't say a thing to her about it. So in between that first and second showing you to Mary, something happened. What happened? Well, apparently he went to his Father. I think that's Ephesians 4. He led captivity captive and gave gifts to men. I think that's when he led captivity captive. I wish I could write this. Maybe someday I'll do a whole timeline, and it takes like 3 hours. For me to do my timeline of history, of redemptive history, it's a three-hour class. It really is a three-hour class, because I try to explain biblically what everything is. So, and give the references for why I believe that fits the way it fits. But I think that has a relationship to paradise, to Sheol in the Old Testament, to paradise and Hades, and I think it has all that fits together. But it also looks toward the tribulation, when you see the souls underneath the altar who are waiting for redemption, who are saying how long. It all plays into all that. But I'm not going to go there this morning. So I think there is sequential. I think there is a time sequence that's revealed to us through the Word of God, and that is the reason I would say no. I don't think it just happened simultaneously, because there seems to be sequence. There seems to be time. So no problem. Did I answer your question, okay, Brian? Okay. I mean, I'm not going to answer every question completely, but that's the position I hold, and I think I can back it up. I don't think what he's saying here is that he had to first offer sacrifice for his own blood. If that's the case, he would have to do it twice for all. He didn't. He did it once for all. And that is the contrast that's being made. That's the contrast that's being made is he didn't have to offer for himself. He just went in once for all. His blood was pure. So, yeah. So where were we when we started all that?
You were done.
Finished 20. So we're in 28, actually, where we were. We're talking about his position as a son and not a servant. And so law appoints men in their weakness as high priests. Again, and so what appointed the high priest? Was it their own?
No.
Yeah, exactly. I can't think of the word I'm trying to think of. Their own character, their own quality of character. Is that what made them high priest? They go back and look and say, well, you're the best guy. You're the most godly man in all the nation. You are now the high priest. Is that how it happened? No. It was the law that said because you're a Levite and because you're a descendant of Aaron and you're the rightful descendant for this place, you get to be high priest. No matter how crooked you were, no matter how, and trust me, there are a lot of crooked high priests. There were a lot of crooked high priests that were not really godly men at all. But because the law said this is the high priest, guess who the high priest was? That was that. The law appointed that in high priest. But the oath of God is what appointed the Son of God as the high priest after the order of Melchizedek forever. And it's based on an oath on his because of his character, because of his position, and because of his purity. He is then made forever high priest after the order of Melchizedek, which covers intercedes for all men, not just for Jews. So those are the four summary statements because of his permanence, because of his purity, because of his place, and because of his position. He is therefore a superior high priest to any Aaronic high priest that ever existed on the earth. None of them is superior to him. He's superior to all of them. That's important because as we get into chapter 8, he's going to talk about because he's the superior high priest, he mediates a superior covenant. That's what comes next. So he is just building his case for the superiority of Christ to everything that a Jew would have known. Hank?
Why did it mention specifically that the oath came later than the law? It seems like earlier, much was made of the fact that the Melchizedekian order was before the priesthood.
Yeah. I had an answer to that last week. What is my answer this week? It's the same answer. I just try to remember because I thought we were getting here last week, if you recall. I thought we were going to get through this, and that's a question I anticipated for last week.
How naive can you be?
I know. And I had my answer ready for that, but I don't exactly remember what it is now. It skipped out of my head. It's really weird. I do. I'll wait till next week. I will answer that question next week before we get in chapter 8. What is it? Oh, it is a very good answer. I'll tell you, it's a very good answer. And it's based on exactly what you said. It's based on the previous Melchizedek predates, and the oath comes. I'm going to have to.
It's not a burning question.
It's important. It's one of those. I actually looked at it. I actually did look at it. I actually anticipated that question, and I had an answer. That's why I probably should write stuff down, but I don't. That is the oath in Psalm 110. That Psalm 110 oath, the Lord has sworn that he and will not change his mind.
Well,
you are a priest forever. Yeah, but the oath is actually, Psalm 110:4 is where the oath is actually sworn to Messiah. That is Jesus. That's where the oath is sworn. The Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. That's the oath. That's being referred referred to. And that's just, you know, basic literature points back to that oath. That's the only oath that's talked about in the text. Jim? Yep.
Whereas the other priests, none of them.
Right. Yeah, the Aaronic priests, none of them represent all mankind. The Aaronic high priest never represented all of mankind, which is, that's important that he is not a priest from the order of Aaron. If that's the case, then we as Gentiles are pretty much hopeless. It's good. I wish I could remember what I was going to say about that. Maybe I'll just send it out as an email. No, I'll wait till next week. I don't like to type.
Oh. Call me. I'll type it up. That way we'll get into 8, actually.
We're going to get into 8.
No.
We're going to, maybe.
You sure?
Just send out the answer.
I'll see if I can type it up. I'll see if I can get it typed up. So, anyway, there we go. Kind of finished 7. Thanks for asking that question and making it so we didn't. So,
I'm trying to help you finish. It's done.
Yep, I'll type it out. All right. 5 minutes early. But I got nothing else to say about 7. I'm not getting to 8 now. I'm just not doing it.
Thank you, Brian.
You're welcome. Thanks for coming. Thanks for being excited about the Word of God. It's fun.